Can you imagine what a party the Song at the Sea must have been? The Israelites have made it to safety. The Red Sea parted. They passed through it in this miraculous passageway to liberation. The Egyptian army, their fierce enemies, have been wiped out in the waves behind them, and they are on their way to freedom. It has to have been better than any New Year's party I've ever been to. And you have to imagine that the actual passing through the sea must have been incredible, with these huge walls of water on either side and dry land under your feet. And if you're like me, you probably have a pretty clear image of how it all happened, of what it looked like. As Charlton Heston raises his mighty staff and a huge wind comes and parts the way. But there is another story of how the waters were parted that has come down to us through the Jewish oral tradition of Midrash. I want to share this story with you that gives us another image of what the liberation looks like. In this other story, it says that when the Egyptian army were behind the Israelites, closing in on them, and the sea was in front of them, blocking their way, they began yelling at Moses, complaining to him that they had been taken out of the safety and security of slavery in Egypt. Moses does what any of us probably would have done. He turns to God and he says, "Well, you got us into this. What now?" But God rebukes Moses and tells him to stop complaining and turn around and just keep walking. Well, Moses turns around and looks at the waters in front of him, and he freezes. He is paralyzed with fear and uncertainty. Not an unreasonable response. So another person, a man named Nachshon, a leader of his own tribe, begins to wade into the water. Nachshon steps into the water, up to his ankles, thinking that God will part the waters and create that passage to freedom, but it doesn't happen. So he walks in all the way up to his waist, thinking surely God is about to clear the way, but nothing. When he is up to his neck, he is sure God is just about to do something, but nothing happens. The story says that it's only when the waters began lapping up over his nostrils, and he began gasping for air, that God parted the waters before him. In this story, God wanted to free the Israelites, but first they had to do their part. Liberation didn't come because they sat back in comfort and asked politely. If you have ever worked to transform our government or any major institution for that matter, the story of Nachshon may feel familiar to you. He was in almost over his head before the way began to clear. Sometimes when I hear stories like this, I try and find myself in the story. Which character would I have been? What role would I have played if I had been there, whether it happened or not? I still want to find myself in the story. To be honest, I'm no Nachshon. I'm probably not Moses or Pharaoh. I would have liked to think that I probably would have been one of the bystanders watching Nachshon wade into water, and I would like to think of myself that I might have been one of the supportive ones at least. Just shouting, "You keep up the good work, Nachshon. I'm right behind you as soon as it's dry. Just let me know if you want me to sign a petition, though. I'm here for you." What gives a person such faith in the path before them that they would wade in not just up to their feet or their waist or even their neck, but until they began gasping for air? Shane Claiborne, a radical Christian activist, talks about doing justice work even when it's hard. And he says, "Some of us have caught a glimpse of the promised land. And it is so dazzling. It is so dazzling that our eyes are forever fixed on it, never to look back at the ways of the old empire again. I imagine that Nakshon had seen, somewhere in his heart, a dazzling glimpse of the Promised Land. He saw where his people were headed, and no water was going to stop him from walking there. One of the first real discussions I ever participated in on the subject of racism was years ago in a white people's identity group at a UU annual meeting. I was sitting in this oversized convention center room, a dozen white college and high school students talking about race, and someone said these words that just hit me. They gave a definition and they said, racism is the name of a system that pushes down one group of people, people of color. But the other half of the system is the lifting up of another group with unearned advantage, white folks. Now, I've gone on to learn more since then about what that lifting up and pushing down looks like. But that sentence, that definition, had articulated what had been for me the missing half of the story on race. I felt like until that moment, every conversation I'd ever had about racism was about African Americans or people who were oppressed, people of color. No one had ever talked about white people's role in it, even though they were the ones that created it and the ones that benefited from it. This other half of the story finally included me and my place in things. I started to look back on my life at these invisible forces that, like gravity, had been shaping the world around me and pushing me in a certain direction, however quietly. I began to look back on all of these times that the forces of racism had nudged me in a certain direction. The time the police let me go with a warning, the first good-paying job I ever got through a family friend, everyone who ever said I looked like a leader, the private school I went to. There was the other time the police let me go with a warning. Honors classes I took that in my school were largely segregated. Strangers who have naturally trusted me. My own trust in the government to be on my side. And last but not least, the other time the police let me go with a warning. Coming to look honestly at my place in this story, to look honestly at my place in this old empire of ours, has often felt like going in over my head. How uncomfortable to realize that, despite my best intentions, I am sometimes in the position of the Israelites fleeing the Egyptians, but that I am also at the same time one of the Egyptians. Most of the Egyptians weren't bad people, you know. They were born into an unjust system. They were raised up in a system where exploitation of the most vulnerable was built into their economy. I can understand that. The sneaky thing about white privilege is that I didn't ask for it. It's been like finding some extra money folded up in my back pocket. We have schools funded locally by segregated property taxes, extra money in my back pocket. We have a segregated housing market that has inherited the legacy of redlining, concentrating wealth in white neighborhoods, extra money in my back pocket. We have a racist tax code, for that matter, that allows those who accumulated wealth in a time of institutionalized segregation to pass that wealth on to their children, too much untaxed. We have institutionalized racial segregation at every level of our society. It is built into our economy. I'm living in Egypt as an Egyptian. Walking uncomfortably into these conversations about race, going into the discomfort, though, up to my neck, has given me, I hope, a vision of the way forward. A vision of the way to move towards that promised land of justice and equity and compassion. A land far beyond any horizon we can see today. A land many of us probably won't get to, but a land we can move towards together. Our country is in some troubled water, and it's important to remember that no one election is going to bring us to the promised land of justice. We will be wandering in the wilderness for some time yet to come. But wading into those waters can bring us to the other side, can help us find the path forward. I don't know if there is a God out there who has specific opinions about how we go about making change in the material world. My experience, though, tells me that God or no God, some plans work better than others. Sitting back in comfort and asking politely for change tends not to work. It is rare to find a story of societal transformation without someone wading into very troubled water, without someone moving forward into the depths, holding fast to a vision, that glimpse of the promised land. I can't say for sure where I would have found myself in this story. I can't say for sure which character I would have been if I had been there on the shores of the sea, trapped between an ocean and an army. But I can say that I have known some modern-day Nakshones, and I am planning to try my best to wade into the water behind them, to follow them on that path forward. As it says in the policy platform for the Movement for Black Lives, it is time to forge a new covenant. And so, beloveds, the religious life can give us a glimpse of the promised land, that land of justice and equity and compassion, and we all have different parts to play in the story. If you know some modern-day Nakshones, please join me in following them into the water. We all have different parts to play in the movement. So if you see some troubled water, if you think there might be a path forward to get us a little closer, let's together take the next step. Let's move. Let's make a movement. I invite you to wade into the troubled water of discomfort, of conversation, and of collective action. I invite you to turn your back on this old empire of ours and join me in recommitting to a Unitarian Universalism that speaks of the promised land in the here and the now, and walks steadily into the water to get there together. May it be so, and may we make it so. Amen.